Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth and productivity of Florida depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust encourages all businesses to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital staff members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capital Report.
Candidates from North Florida's Congressional District 2 are trying to stand out from the crowd.
We have seen the field littered right now with people who had more money in a campaign and lost because they did not have the grassroots game in place. And this is going to be that kind of race, District 2.
This week, a federal judge threw out Jefferson County's local districts for including prison inmates.
The inmates are located in Jefferson. They're counted as part of this population, but they're not receiving any representation whatsoever.
And we'll take a deep dive into public health issues like chronic diseases, STDs, and the state's ongoing efforts to fight human trafficking. Plus, a look at the more than 1,200 unsolved cold cases in the state. That's ahead on Capital Report. I'm Lynn Hatter, in for Tom Flanagan, and this is Capital Report. Welcome to tonight's show. Four Republicans and a Libertarian, all relatively unknown, are slugging it out to replace first-term Democratic Congresswoman Gwen Graham in newly redrawn District 2. Graham says she'll wait on the outcome of a challenge to the map before deciding her future. But the candidates are forging ahead. The North Florida race heats up next week when the Republicans meet in Panama City for their first debate. And Jim Ash has this overview.
Graham remains the big question mark. A spokesman says she's waiting for the outcome of a redistricting lawsuit before deciding whether to run. That leaves a Panama City urologist, two Tallahassee attorneys, a Fort White businessman, and a Gulf County Libertarian Party activist. None has held office. All claim to be outsiders. All promise change. The district is more Republican than it was, but the candidates have an uphill climb, says University of South Florida political scientist Susan McManus.
We have seen the field littered right now with people who had more money in a campaign and lost because they did not have the grassroots game in place. And this is going to be that kind of race, District 2.
And voters are unusually skittish, McManus says, adding that the sluggish economy, terrorism, and random mass shootings are taking a toll on the public mood. So with that, meet the candidates. Dr. Neil Dunn was an Army surgeon before launching a successful medical practice and founding a commercial bank. Dunn serves on Enterprise Florida and Space Florida, the state's public-private business development arm. Like his fellow Republicans, he promises to tackle the deficit, repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, and keep the military strong.
In those three areas, national security at home and abroad, economy, jobs, and health care, are the three professional areas that I've worked in my entire life.
Mary Thomas is general counsel for Governor Rick Scott's Department of Elder Affairs. A Florida State University law grad, she would be the first Indian American woman to serve in Congress. She not only wants to cut taxes and government regulations, she would abolish the IRS and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. A triathlete, she stresses her youth and vigor.
As a 37-year-old wife, a mom of a 2.5-year-old son, and a first-generation American, and a constitutional conservative property rights attorney, I offer the Republican primary voters of District 2 the best choice to change the direction of our country.
Jeff Moran spent 22 years as a law enforcement officer in Broward County before moving to Fort White to start his custom car business. Moran favors smaller government, lower taxes, and fewer government regulations. He says politics will never be a career.
It's jobs, the economy, and national security are obviously the three priorities that I think everybody's concerned with. But it's basically just getting the country back on track.
Former U.S. Attorney Ken Sukaya is a Cornell graduate who earned his law degree from the University of Florida. He spent most of his career in the courtroom battling drug lords and child pornographers and promoting conservative causes. He was appointed by former President George H.W. Bush and worked for George W. Bush and Jeb Bush. He stresses his Christian faith.
I don't think it's enough to say you're conservative. I think it's important that we send someone to Washington who's been tested, who's fought those battles.
Rob Laffam, Secretary of the Gulf County Libertarian Party, is the only non-Republican in the race. The retired IT executive is new to North Florida and spent much of his career in Alaska and Houston. He says he became active in the Libertarian Party 5 years ago. Government intrusion and deficit spending are his biggest concerns.
The deficit started growing right after Calvin Coolidge left office 88 years ago. And every one of the 14 presidents since has raised the increase the national debt, and every Congress has voted for it. I'm disgusted.
Dunn leads the other three candidates in money and endorsements, but he says establishment backing doesn't make him an establishment candidate. Thomas works inside the Scott administration, but she insists that doesn't make her an insider. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
A recent federal court ruling is calling into question how prison populations should be treated when it comes to redistricting. Nick Evans reports a judge has invalidated Jefferson County's local district boundaries.
Rural Jefferson County sits just to the east of Tallahassee. Internally, it's split into five districts for elected seats like school board and the county commission. In the last census, Jefferson had just short of 15,000 residents. The districts are small, just a couple thousand people, and the number of eligible voters is even smaller. That's why the American Civil Liberties Union got involved after the last round of redistricting.
So in our case, in Jefferson County, the county is divided into five districts. And one of those districts included the prison. And in that prison district, the prisoners represented over 40% of the voting age population.
This is Nancy Abudu.
And I'm the legal director for the ACLU of Florida.
Abudu argues Jefferson County's District 3 violates one person, one vote principles because the large population of non-voting prisoners amplifies the voice of the remaining residents. The ACLU calls this prison gerrymandering.
There's actually several counties in Florida that also use prisons when they draw their county and school board lines. Henry County is one that stands out to me. Several other rural counties do as well.
That's Matthew Isbell, a left-leaning mapping contractor. According to the Prison Policy Initiative, an organization that tracks prison gerrymandering throughout the country, there are 9 additional Florida counties adding inmates to their municipal districts. But after Judge Mark Walker's ruling, that may change. It's the first time a federal judge has ruled against prison gerrymandering, and he's ordered Jefferson County to revise its borders by early April, warning the court will step in if the county fails. But Isbell expects the county will comply.
There's no reason we can't go ahead with new lines for the 2016 elections. So, I mean, this should all be resolved fairly quickly, unless the county decides to appeal. And honestly, if they do, they're just dragging it out. They're going to cost themselves more money. It's honestly not worth it for them to fight this.
Abudu says the ruling will put other counties on notice, but they're not the only people paying attention.
And it has 25 prisons in the district. Wow. Wow. 25 prisons.
That's Democratic Congresswoman Corrine Brown. She's challenging Florida's newest congressional map under the Voting Rights Act, because she says the number of prisons included in her district's population count will diminish minority voting power.
Everybody says, well, you can win anywhere. It's not about me winning. It's about the African-Americans having an opportunity to elect a candidate of their choice.
This is different than the ACLU's challenge in Jefferson County. Brown's case has to do with minority representation, whether African-American candidates have a fair shot in the district, while the Jefferson case focuses on simple population disparity. Abudu says Brown might have a point, but it depends on how the district actually performs.
That argument for sure shouldn't just be tossed out as completely unreasonable. I think you really have to look at the analysis to see whether she can support such a claim.
But Isbell isn't buying Brown's claims. He says historical data shows a district with strong African-American participation. And he says the prison population just isn't that big.
And the total prison population of this newly proposed Congressional District 5 is somewhere between 1 and 2% of the total population of the district.
The Jefferson County Commission is slated to meet Monday to figure out how to proceed. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Governor Rick Scott has approved a controversial bill restricting state funding to organizations that provide elective abortions. The measure is similar to a law in Texas that's pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. Lakeland Republican Senator Kelly Stargell's bill increases surgical standards on clinics, requires abortion providers to have admitting privileges and agreements with local hospitals, and redefines the length of a trimester.
Would I like a bill that outlaws abortion? Sure, but that's not what this bill does, because that's unconstitutional, because we're allowed to have a woman's right to choose.
Oh my God, he's opposed to putting the government between people and their doctors, except when it comes to Florida's women.
ACLU of Florida Executive Director Howard Simon blasted the governor for signing the bill. He's waiting to see how the Florida Supreme Court rules on a separate law establishing an abortion waiting period before deciding whether to challenge HB 1411.
And when it comes to Florida's women, he'll sign any restriction whatsoever. I think this is depressing, but not at all unexpected.
Meanwhile, the Florida Family Policy Council is claiming a major victory. Last year, the council's John Stemberger blasted Governor Rick Scott for not banning state funding from flowing to Planned Parenthood amid a national uproar over the group's disposal and sale of fetal remains for research.
Well, you know, we would have liked for him to just, by executive order, defund Planned Parenthood without having to go through this process. We've had a sustained campaign for at least the last 7 months asking him to do that. But we are pleased that he signed this today. He did the right thing. And so we're happy about that. We wish he would have exercised leadership. But he followed the leadership of the legislature, and so that's good. Same result has occurred.
Florida's Planned Parenthood clinics say they'll weather the coming storm. Laura Goodhue heads the Florida Alliance of Planned Parenthood Affiliates.
It's just a shame that politicians like Governor Rick Scott and the bill sponsors are taking the chance to launch these political attacks. But the health centers will continue to be there for the patients.
Still to come on Capitol Report, lawmakers approved a new provision that could change the way Florida doctors treat people with certain sexually transmitted infections.
That disease continues to come back to that patient, and so you get involved in this endless cycle where you really can't cure the disease because you're not treating the partner.
A national healthcare policy organization is working to build its first partnership in Florida.
Not just raising awareness about the problem, but pointing out solutions that are working and how we can really make those solutions work more broadly for everyone.
And Florida officials say anti-human trafficking efforts may be doing all right so far, but they now want to get out of the planning stage.
Now it's time to put them to work. I feel like it's building a house. Last year we looked at the plans, talked about the plans. We know what we want to do, and this year I think we're going to actually see the progress.
There are plenty of reasons a person might not seek treatment of a sexually transmitted disease or STD. Embarrassment, lack of knowledge, or lack of access. But Florida health officials say treatment is essential, not only to that person's health, but to stop the spread of the disease. Regan McCarthy reports a new bill passed by lawmakers could make getting that treatment easier.
In Florida's capital city, sexually transmitted infections are a serious concern.
Yes, well, in 2015, Leon County ranked number one for gonorrhea and chlamydia rates in the state. And that doesn't mean we had the most cases, but if you look at how many cases we had per 100,000 population, we were number one for gonorrhea and chlamydia.
That's Claudia Blackburn. She's a health officer for the Leon County Health Department and says a big reason for Leon County's high ranking is the area's large student population.
It's most prevalent in 18 to 24-year-olds, so we have an abundance of that population. These are students who maybe are bringing gonorrhea and chlamydia with them from their home county, so that increases our rates here.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the rate for infections like chlamydia is on the rise nationwide. And Blackburn says one of the best ways to fight that is through treatment from a doctor, which can clear up the infection and keep it from getting passed along. But Venice Republican Representative Julio Gonzalez says encouraging people to get that treatment can be easier said than done. And he says if someone goes to the doctor for treatment, it's not a complete solution unless the person's partner is also getting treatment.
The problem then occurs that the gynecologist treats the patient, but because the patient continues to have contact with her partner, that disease continues to come back to that patient. And so you get involved in this endless cycle where you really can't cure the disease because you're not treating the partner.
Gonzalez, who is a doctor himself, says that's a concern he's heard raised for years by his wife, who happens to be a gynecologist.
I've been involved with this conversation way before I ever thought that I would ever be serving in public office. I was having these conversations not only with my wife, but her gynecology friends, and the frustrations that they would meet in not being able to completely treat their patients because they couldn't treat their partners.
But Gonzalez is behind a bill aimed at addressing that. He says a provision that's part of a much larger health care bill would legalize what's called expedited partner therapy.
What that is a provision that would allow a gynecologist to treat the partner of a person who contracted a sexually transmitted disease.
Right now, it's not legal for a doctor in Florida to treat a patient he or she hasn't seen. But under the new provision, doctors would be allowed to treat the partners of patients they're already seeing for certain STDs. The provision covers infections like gonorrhea and chlamydia that can be treated with antibiotics. But it wouldn't allow partner treatment for viral infections like HIV and AIDS. Recent reports show Florida leads the country in new HIV infections. The measure containing the provision is awaiting approval from Governor Rick Scott. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
A national group that supports the Affordable Care Act and wants to expand that support would like to have a presence in Florida. Tom Flanagan reports the Partnership to Fight Chronic Disease is looking for Sunshine State partners.
The partnership is headquartered in Washington, D.C. Its national policy director, Candace DeMatteis, has been making the rounds of major Florida cities explaining what the organization is.
We have business groups, patient groups, provider groups, pharmacy, nursing, physicians. We also have labor, community groups, just really anyone with an interest in health.
These days, with the continuing debate about Obamacare, Medicaid expansion, and all that, it seems more people than ever are concerned about health care, especially the kind of health care that fights chronic diseases, hence the name of DeMatteis' group.
That's diseases like diabetes, heart disease, asthma. The cost to people, individuals, the cost to us as a nation, our economy, and then also not just raising awareness about the problem, but pointing out solutions that are working and how we can really make those solutions work more broadly for everyone.
The need, says DeMatteis, is to keep more people from contracting these illnesses.
The World Health Organization estimates that 80% of premature heart disease, stroke, and type 2 diabetes, 40% of all cancers are entirely avoidable.
And the group's primary goal is increasing that incidence of avoidability.
We want to improve access to recommended care, and that's critically important as well, so people have access to the care they need and the services that they need to stay healthy.
DeMatteis admits that goal is more difficult in a state like Florida, which has opted not to expand Medicaid coverage under the Affordable Care Act. Even so, she thinks there can be some not altogether satisfactory alternatives.
We see a lot of people, programs using community health workers, for example, and peer coaching to help people kind of extend that primary care base, if you will. People are educated in knowing what the signs and symptoms are, knowing what they need to do in their daily lives to maintain their health. And those programs are really important as well to kind of help extend that access issue.
Besides access, the Partnership to Fight Chronic Disease aims to reduce health care cost. DeMatteis says part of that involves determining best practices for health care delivery while still taking regional differences into account.
You're not trying to treat people in Miami with something that was developed in Tallahassee, for example, that may not work as well. It's a real challenge and a delicate balance, there's no question. But I think if we can find those common elements of best practices that can be adopted and then preserve that flexibility, that really is the holy grail, if you will, in how we deliver care the best.
So far, some 17 Florida organizations have joined the partnership. They include the Florida Psychiatric Society and AIDS Institute. DeMatteis and her boss, partnership chair Kenneth Thorpe, who was on President Bill Clinton's cabinet, hope there will be many more. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Tom Flanagan.
And as Florida's Human Trafficking Council continues working to combat modern-day slavery, some members say they're frustrated with how long it's taking to implement solutions. Sasha Cordner brings us that story.
Attorney General Pam Bondi leads the 15-member statewide Council on Human Trafficking. During a recent meeting, she outlined what's been done so far.
In its first full year, of course, the council heard many presentations. It provoked discussion. And it helped us to get a better understanding of the problem of human trafficking and provided us with information that was necessary for the coming year.
But she admits she's also disappointed in the progress.
Frankly, during the end of the year, I was a bit frustrated, and I think probably many of you were, because I feel like, and I guess you have to do this sometimes, we talk about the problem a lot without coming to solutions. You know, I think the last year we've been planning our work, but this year we are committed to working our plan. And that's what we're going to see. And I know it takes time to do that.
The council is divided into three areas: services and resources, legislative and special initiatives, and criminal justice. The services and resources subpanel is led by Florida Department of Children and Family Secretary Mike Carroll. He's also the vice chair of the statewide human trafficking council.
Our biggest challenge moving forward is how do we take what's working and how do we replicate it on a statewide basis? We have to know the numbers. We have to understand where to put it. And we especially need to understand, even if you replicate it, how do you begin building that continuity of care that's so important for these victims as they travel through our service delivery system.
Carroll says he, too, has been frustrated. One area he'd like to see improve is the ability to better track human trafficking.
We continue to be challenged at our ability to arrive at reliable data and prevalences. Tips and calls to the abuse hotline do not necessarily correlate to the actual number of human trafficking. The public and media may identify a crime as human trafficking, but there may not be enough evidence to charge, prosecute, and convict. So we have many calls that come into the hotline where human trafficking is suspected. It doesn't mean that they're all verified.
But Carroll says it's not all bad. He says his agency is working with the Department of Juvenile Justice. That agency uses a screening tool to aid in human trafficking prevention efforts. Carroll says it's helped in tracking victims. And DJJ Secretary Christy Daly says her agency is just wrapping up its first full year of using the human trafficking screening tool. Victims are asked a series of questions looking into different areas of their background as a way to identify them as a potential human trafficking victim. That includes if they've ever ran away, felt threatened, or pressured into sexual activity. Daly says so far about 2,500 kids have been screened.
Just under 1,300 of those resulted in a call to the abuse hotline with an acceptance rate of 52%. Of the calls made, 576 were accepted. And this, to me, you know, really tells us that we are really identifying the right kids to call in. Of the accepted calls, 41% were for males and 60% were for females.
Daly says she's continuing to look into ways to improve the tool and is expanding its use to other providers like the Pace Center for Girls. The next council meeting will focus on the Legislative and Special Initiatives Subcommittee. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
In Jacksonville alone, more than 1,200 murders remain unsolved. It's hard to estimate the number statewide because different agencies keep records differently. This year, Florida lawmakers approved $50,000 to create a task force to study all of them and identify best practices for solving old murders. But Governor Rick Scott vetoed it. The proposal was based on Colorado's Cold Case Task Force, created 7 years ago. Lindsay Kilbride of WJCT in Jacksonville looked into how it's working in that state.
Ryan Backman doesn't know who killed his father.
Clifford Backman, he was 56 years old.
He was working construction one afternoon in Jacksonville 6 years ago.
My dad was vacuuming up drywall dust put the gun in his back, pulled the trigger, and reached in and pulled the wallet out of my dad's back pocket.
Backman has since formed the advocacy group Project Cold Case. He's been working with Northeast Florida Republican Senator Aaron Bean on legislation he believes could help solve murders. Bean estimates there are more than 15,000 in the state, but it's difficult to nail down the exact number because police departments lack uniformity. Bean says the vetoed funding would have covered travel expenses for a 19-member volunteer task force.
That will hopefully kind of nail down what a cold case is, define it, agree on the parameters of when details should be released or what details are. Sometimes never release details, but something that we could launch a database of some sort in Florida.
This was Bean's third year sponsoring cold case legislation. He says the Florida Department of Law Enforcement has told him a task force would cost millions of dollars.
We think that's ludicrous. But this past year, you know, they have said, okay, Senator Bean, go out and get us some money to launch this task force, and then we'll run it. And that's what we did this year. That's why we're scratching our heads.
The governor says he vetoed the money because the department didn't request it directly, and he didn't understand where the money would go. Bean's bill was based on one Colorado passed in 2007 that created a task force and cold case database.
It certainly got the topic in the public, and it kind of got the topic going around in law enforcement. So it brought it more to our attention that it's something that we needed to look at.
Audrey Simpkins runs Colorado's database. She's a criminal intelligence analyst with the Colorado Bureau of Investigation. So far, she's logged more than 1,600 unresolved cases. These days, she says, agencies are better connected with local forensic departments and prosecutors. The Colorado Task Force meets four times a year. Appointed members identify best practices for solving cases and pinpoint where more training is needed. They also created a review team to help agencies solve cold cases. Detectives and forensic experts look at a few cases a year, and in five of those cases, arrests have been made.
So many of these departments came in and were just astonished at how many cold cases that they have in their records. And many didn't even know they had that number. And that's a frightening thought.
Robert Wells sits on Colorado's 16-member task force. Like Ryan Backman, his interest is personal. His brother was murdered. The task force's newest project is printing playing cards with victims' faces on them. The decks of cards were distributed in prisons, and investigators have heard from more than 60 inmates who say they have information. In Florida, even without the task force, the Florida Sheriff's Association has created a review team of its own. It has met once since forming last summer. Senator Bean says he's gearing up to try again for the task force and database.
So you know what they say, the fourth time is a charm, so we're committed.
Advocates are also hopeful about a new Florida law requiring rape kits to be tested more quickly. They say some rapists could also be murderers in their unsolved cases. This is Lindsay Kilbride in Jacksonville.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Ken Smith, and I'm Lynn Hatter. Tom Flanagan will be back next week. Join us each Friday for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust. 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.